agenda. So the purpose this morning is to, we've talked a bit about 76 and some other forums, so we're going to talk just briefly about some of the overview of the 76 status. We're going to spend a bit of time talking about the data from 08 and 2 that Mary Jo is going to present. And we're going to spend a substantial amount of time talking about the newer perinatal protocol 185, which Dick Steen and Lynn Wafinson will present. And then we're going to review some of the progress on the CD4-IgG protocol, and Bill Shearer will talk about that. And again, we have relatively limited time this morning, so we're going to try to stick as much as we can to the agenda, with the purpose being to discuss all the perinatal protocols in one session. So what we'd like to do is that Rhoda is going to just briefly go over some of the issues related to 76, and Rich can add whatever his he needs to.
It was actually the start of the slide of the study design, but I really can't talk about it again. I just want to give people the status of the update of the study. As of November 26th, 16 sites have enrolled patients, and as of November 21st, 30 infants have already been born. 21 babies are already greater than 6 weeks old and have completed therapy. And here's a breakdown of the 66 enrolled mothers by site. Sites sort of staggered in terms of their enrollment. The first site got IRB approval in April and started enrollment later that month, and the majority of the sites came aboard in July and August. The accrual rate has been about 10 patients per month. Here's some of the characteristics of the mothers who entered the study. This is from the Open DSMB report from November. There were 48 mothers who were reviewed at that time. And you can see, of the group, the mean age was 26, the mean CD4 count was above 600. When you broke down the group between CD4 cells between 200 and 500, and those greater than 500, it seemed that two-thirds of the women had CD4 counts above 500. And the breakdown of the gestational age by entry, there was some concern about the inability to recruit early. It looks like the breakdown is about half of them are in the second trimester, and half of them are in the third trimester. And the bottom is just some demographics and race and ethnicity. I just want to wrap up briefly with some possible protocol modifications. There are things that have been discussed, and the team needs to discuss some stratification by maternal CD4 count, as well as the inclusion of additional virologic endpoints earlier in the infancy period. We will put together a committee to work on simplification of the data collection forms. There's been lots of complaints that they're cumbersome. And when we get some additional patients, we will probably adjust the frequency of maternal surveillance. Our initial safety surveillance is sort of optimistic in terms of a lack of antepartum problems associated with drug therapy. And we have a larger population of women and more substantial experience who may be paring down in the frequency of maternal surveillance. That's really all. I'm sort of anxious to get to some of the newer protocols and discussion.
Rich, do you have something? The only report I can make is that the study was reviewed by the DSMB in November, that our plan is to analyze very carefully the pilot study data during February, and that will be made available to the DSMB, and there'll be an open report to inform as to the status of the study at that time. One comment about that Rhoda made about surveillance of the mothers, we're talking about data collection types of surveillance. The normal obstetrical care would continue for your normal practice.
I have a question. I thought that the women who were supposed to be in the study were supposed to have CD4 counts below 500, between 2 and 500.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Above 200.
No. The entry criteria for the study is that you can't be on ACT for your own medical indication. And so that includes routinely recommending 500. There's still some issues as to whether the recommended criteria is based on the way the decision's already been made.
Two-thirds of those women need AZT above 500 T-cells?
Right.
No, these are women who do not need AZT for their own care. As half of the patients in the study will not receive AZT, half will receive AZT for that relatively short period of time. The criteria for inclusion in 076, which is the study that's ongoing and
right.
reported, is not requiring AZT for their own care.
But two-thirds of those women are taking AZT above the CT4 level at which it's recommended.
For maternal health, right. But the endpoint of the study is perinatal transmission.
But there's a woman involved in there who is getting a drug at a time when the basic standard of care in this country is that it's not necessary and it's a toxic drug.
Right. That's why it's in that group of women reasonable to randomize them. What was the feeling of the group was that it would not be reasonable to do a study in which there was randomization of placebo in women who have an infection. So the current study design is to include not have a medical indication, in which case it would not be possible to randomize them because they all need drugs.
Yeah.
But that is what is in the consent form, and that is how the study is presented.
Do those women know that AZ... Well, what I'm asking is, do those women know that if you take AZT for a certain amount of time, that you build up resistance to it, and so therefore, by the time their CD4 counts drop, and they may need it for themselves, that they may be resistant to it and may not be able to use it? Is that in the consent form? Because that's what's going on here. I mean, do people get that?
I think maternal risks and maternal benefits are discussed with the mothers. But
is that particular thing discussed?
I think that's a theoretical possibility, and in that theoretical possibility, it is discussed with the woman. But I don't think you're stating something that's a good scientific fact, and that is a theoretical risk that the woman's taken.
AZT resistance is a theoretical fact?
That if someone is short-term exposure to AZT, then it's theoretical that they will develop clinical problems with drug resistance.
And the drop in their blood count and everything else, this is all theoretical?
No, those are side effects of the drug.
So, but the point is that those are also reasons why when a woman reaches a certain point, she may not be able to take that for herself. All I want to know is that in the consent form?
Yes.
Does a woman know
maternal
that she's...
are in the consent.
That particular one?
Yes. The people's risk, the information varies from side by side, what's included for the IRB, but the maternal risks are discussed and addressed in routine consent form.
Move on. Mary Jo O'Hara.
O'Hara, yeah. All Irish, they're all the same. They all look the same, they all act the same. I think everybody's pretty familiar with the first part of 082, which is the demographic information, of which there were 8 patients enrolled, 7 completed. The study, one dropped out after 2 weeks of therapy while she was in Haiti. And these 7 patients, all of their demographic criteria listed here. The babies, for the sake of everybody who needs to know this, have all completed their 18 months follow-up. In terms of clinical outcomes, for the mothers, there was really no significant maternal bone marrow suppression during the course of pregnancy. The mean entry hemoglobins, as you can see, were 11.56. 1 week prior to delivery, the mean hemoglobins were 11.83. The lowest hemoglobin that patients had was 1 day postpartum, and that was significantly contributed to by one patient who had a massive postpartum hemorrhage at the time of severe infection. So if you put those patients all together, the lowest hemoglobin was 10.96 1 day postpartum, but by 8 weeks post-delivery, the hemoglobins were 13.16, which showed a significant increase. The mean corpuscular volume on entry was 89.9 and increased at the time of delivery to 93.47. What is interesting about this mean corpuscular volume is that it remains stable in the postpartum course. The white blood cell count, total neutrophil count, platelets, there was no significant change except in the platelet count on day 2 postpartum when there was a slight increase, but by day 3 that was normal. The CD4 counts on entry was a mean of 476, and at the time of delivery had increased to 597. One of the interesting things also in relation to the CD4 count is the fact that when you compared each patient to herself, there was a range of increase from none whatsoever to a 217-fold increase each patient compared to herself. Two patients postpartum had CD4 counts 6 weeks postpartum, which was still in the low range, that is below 500. Those patients were placed on AZT and are still on AZT. One more patient had dropped her CD4 count since the completion of the study, and so now three patients of the seven who completed the study are on AZT. As far as clinical outcomes are concerned, from the fetal point of view, all infants, when evaluated by every single measure that we have intrauterine, were perfectly normal by growth and biophysical profiles and non-stress testing, all of which were reactive. The infants were all born with normal Apgar scores, normal cord gases, normal pHs at delivery. They were all term-sized infants. In fact, three of the babies were over 4,000 grams. The only significant complication in the initial immediate neonatal period was that one infant developed a ureaplasma pneumonia and was on a ventilator quite ill for several days and was treated with erythromycin. That baby, of course, did get some blood in the nursery, as is characteristic of all kids in a neonatal intensive care unit when they have multiple blood testing for pHs. Mom had had an episode of ureaplasma cervicitis during the pregnancy, had been treated with erythromycin during the pregnancy. One of the other interesting things about this same patient is that she had a previous child who was delivered at approximately the same gestational age who also had respiratory distress syndrome after birth. From the point of view of the hemoglobin hematocrits of the neonates, they were all on the low range of normal at birth, that is that they were all approximately 14.4. The normal neonatal hemoglobin by any criteria that we could find, which really comes out of most European literature and northern North American literature, was approximately 16 grams plus or minus 1.65. The total white cell counts are listed here. There was a range of 19,000 plus or minus 6,000 at delivery, and the ANC counts were 9,642, again with a very wide range, but all felt to be within normal limits. Follow-up of the infants shows that all of the infants developed a mild normocytic normochromic anemia with a nadir in the hemoglobin of approximately 4 weeks of gestation. Mean hemoglobin hematocrits are listed here, 29 for the hematocrit and 9.8 for the hemoglobin. This drop in hemoglobin hematocrit was felt to be slightly earlier than one would have expected for the normal newborn, and one has to consider in this the fact that the children had multiple blood samples drawn over those first 4 weeks of life, which may have partly contributed to this anemia. The lowest counts, the ANC counts, were again at least 4 to 8, the mean was 2,426, and one infant at 12 weeks was as low as 1,500, which spontaneously resolved. As far as treatment of the children with anemia, two of the children received iron, all of the children resolved and had their hemoglobins in the normal range by 12 weeks postpartum. You're familiar with, and I've shown this before, but just for review, this upper graphs are the metabolites of AZT. The lower triangles are AZT itself. This is the intravenous 200 milligrams on day one. This is the oral 200 milligrams on day two. And you can see that the peak value intravenously was the completion of the transfusion. There was a rapid drop-off and then a slow drop-off after that. From the oral dose, that the same level was not achieved as was achieved in the intravenous dose, and then a slow drop-off in terms of the remainder of the AZT in the patient's circulation. I'm going to just briefly mention that the half-life of AZT in the pregnant woman was approximately the same as it is in the normal adult. Steady-state volume of distribution, the central compartment volume of distribution, and the clearance were essentially the same as they were in the non-pregnant individual. This is felt to be due to the fact that the metabolism of this drug is predominantly by the liver, and liver metabolism during pregnancy is essentially unchanged over the non-pregnant state. Now, this is confusing, but all it's trying to do is to show you that if you look at the maternal ZDV levels at delivery, the cord ZDV levels at delivery, and the neonatal ZDV levels shortly after delivery, you can see that there's a very close association, especially between the umbilical vein and the neonatal plasma. And these that when you compare them, show that the ratio from the umbilical vein to the maternal vein is 1.25, which implies a slight increase in the amount of ZDV on the fetal side of the circulation. When you compare the neonatal level to the umbilical vein level, again, you see a slight increase on the side of the neonatal circulation, but essentially approaches one. When it comes to the disappearance of drug in the neonatal circulation, I want to point out first that the range in the neonate of ZDV was 0.15, and you can see this here, but the graph is confusing, 0.15 to 0.59. The mean you already saw for the neonate was 0.29, and for the umbilical cord was 0.28. And you can see that the half-life in these children is markedly prolonged, and the drug remains around time. In fact, the half-life is tenfold greater than that in the maternal circulation, or approximately 13 hours. And this is important when dosing children now in 076. The next part of this is to present some of the preliminary data that comes out of the intravenous study. Now, the intravenous study are patients who did not receive any ZDV, and in fact, none of these had received ZDV prior to labor and delivery, and then received two milligrams per kilogram loading dose, followed by 1 milligram per kilogram maintenance dose during the course of labor and delivery until the time delivered. And I'm going to show just two, the lowest and the highest, and then give you the levels. This gives you the maternal levels. The triangle being the maternal ZDV, the open triangle, and the closed triangle being the fetal ZDV. The other is the metabolite. And you can see that with the loading dose followed by the maintenance, there's a steady state maintained in the maternal circulation, that it would appear that the neonatal levels are essentially almost equal to the maternal levels, though slightly lower. And you can see that the maternal drug disappearance is much faster than the fetal drug disappearance. Patient was in labor 18 hours. Most of the patients had ZDV between 6 and 8 hours. This patient was received the drug for a total of 18 hours prior to delivery and had the highest concentrations of drug both in the maternal and the fetal circulation. The concentration in the maternal circulation at the time of delivery was 1.32 nanograms and in the baby after birth 1.02 nanograms. And you can see that the steady state maintained during the course of labor and delivery in the mother, and then the levels in the infant, again, a lower drop-off because of the prolonged half-life than in the mother, where the rate of drop-off was considerably faster. There's one patient who's completed that I don't have data on, and it would have been very interesting. This is a case out of UCLA with a set of twins, where they did the pharmacokinetics on both babies as well as on the mom. And I don't have that information yet, and there's one more patient in the pike who has not yet delivered. When I tried to summarize this data from the patients, the five cases that were completed, we have a slightly different set of numbers in terms of what happens to concentration. The mean concentration in the mom's plasma just at the time of delivery was 0.72. It's approximately twice that which occurred when we were using the 140 milligrams and using it every 4 hours. And the neonatal concentration mean level was 0.6, which again is approximately twice the level that we had when we were using 140 milligrams. So it would certainly appear that, first of all, by increasing the dose or by maintaining a steady state, and when I was looking at the dose relationships for the total dose received, it actually wasn't a lot different in the short labors, but it was in the longer labors between 140 every four and the 2 milligrams followed by one. The interesting thing, too, is that when you look at the ratios between the maternal blood and the neonatal blood, instead of the ratio being slightly greater than one, where it was in the other one, 1.2, in this one, it's slightly less than one. And the ratio here is approximately 0.83, which means that either way, there still appears to be an almost equivalent level of drug in the fetal circulation as compared to the maternal circulation. And lastly, in one patient, we have zidovudine, we have data on from who have received methadone patients, another arm of the study. This is very preliminary. I had just got this data before I left, so I've had no real time to discuss it with anybody. But this patient received 100 milligrams. We decided for the first two patients on methadone to look at 100 milligrams as the dose intravenously during pregnancy, IV, and then orally, to do the pharmacokinetics on two of those patients before we decided what the dose or maintenance dose with those patients would be, whether it would increase to 200 milligrams as has been done on the chronic study initially, or whether these patients should be maintained on 100 because of the liver metabolism changes that might occur with a combination of methadone and AZT. And the levels here are a little bit erratic, but on the oral dose, you can see that there was an initial rise, and this is on 100 milligrams that approaches almost the exact same level that is present with 200 milligrams being given to patients who are not on methadone. So this is the IV, and then this is the oral dosing of those patients. So based upon one patient, I can't say very much as yet, but once we get the rest of the data together, and the second patient will be able to decide whether 100 milligrams really is a sufficient dose on patients on methadone as contrasted to what we were doing with non-methadone patients. Any questions?
That was actually the 49 data is what the 76 dosing was based on, and models that data. The problem, obviously, is that in that group of patients, they did not have frequent the stimulants related to the clearance of the drug. Have reasonable doses here. And if they're behind zero, it doesn't seem, based on the pharmacokinetics of everything, to change that. But as you know, the clearance when you get to the end of the data. It's clear that nobody is getting drugs within the first four hours. Most of the patients are not getting drugs. So the 4 hour interval is calorie. It does from everybody in our group. It's Mary Jo Sullivan.
Okay.
You got listed. You got translated. I'm going to move on to the 185 protocol.
First of all, the copies of it back there. Click on the slide.
What?
185 is a study on the use of hyperimmune intravenous immune globulin in an attempt to prevent transmission of HIV from mothers to baby. The hypothesis is that hyperimmune human IVIG given during pregnancy to HIV-positive women will reduce the rate of maternal-fetal transmission. That's why. There's a manual thing up here. This protocol was developed by a unique collaboration between NIAID, National Institute for Child Health, the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, Abbott Laboratories, and it's evolved since early June, a series of meetings here in Washington. I and Jack Lambert of Rochester are the protocol co-chairs, but they had a great deal of input from many other people, particularly Lynn Moffinson, Bonnie Matheson, James Walsley, Dr. Nemo, Steve Duraco, and Jerry Hirsch, and Larry Cummins, so that this was not my effort, but a collaborative effort by a lot of people. Next slide. The timing of vertical transmission, when transmission occurs from mother to baby, is not completely clear. It's been estimated that it may occur in about 20 to 30% prior to the onset of labor, perhaps 5 to 10% in the first trimester, 5 to 10% in the second trimester, and 5 to 10% in the third trimester. Likely, the majority of transmission occurs around the time of birth, perhaps 70 to 80%, and very rarely postpartum by breastfeeding. But this is the area that we hope to affect by this protocol. Next slide. So, yeah. Pardon? Wild estimation. So the ideal treatment to try to interrupt pregnancy transmission would include treatment during pregnancy in the intrapartum period and intensively postpartum. Next slide. Perhaps the theoretical basis for the use of hyperimmune IVIG is a study that if a mother has certain antibodies, a pregnant mother has certain antibodies, she's less likely to transmit than a woman that does not have these antibodies. These are primarily antibodies to the GP120V3 loop, and a summary of some data from three different groups indicates that women that do not transmit have this antibody in 64% of individuals, and women who do transmit only have this antibody in about 12%. There's some recent data that suggests this might not be so, but the hope is that some protective antibody in this protection, in this preparation, may decrease the risk of transmission. The product that we will be evaluating is a hyperimmune IVIG that has been derived from HIV-infected asymptomatic individuals with CD4 counts greater than 400. It has been selected because of a high titer to P24, but it has high titers to a great number of other HIV epitopes. It's been fractionated by alcohol and solvent and detergent. It's 98% IgG, and it's made up as a 5% solution. The antibody content, as I mentioned, has extremely high ELISA titers to P24. It also has high neutralization antibodies and does not enhance the uptake of HIV into susceptible cells at high doses of HIV-IG. The safety of this has been determined. It's negative on culture and PCR, so the fractionation procedure, both the chemical and the physical characterization, is such that it will remove all the possibility of transmitting virus. And this is also so for regular gamma globulin, which this is essentially the same as, except for the high titer of antibodies to HIV. It has been used in 13 humans that are far advanced, and there has been no significant problems with safety. It reduces the level of P24. There hasn't been much therapeutic benefit, but other people have suggested that the use of plasma may be therapeutically effective. It's been tested in chimpanzees and will prevent infection after a chimpanzee is given a low dose of HIV, but not after a high dose of virus. Next slide. The entry the criteria for this protocol will be such that it will not conflict with 076, so that all these women who agree to participate will be on DDV because of CD4 counts less than 500 or AIDS-defining illness. And this decision is not part of this protocol, so all of these women have elected because their doctor has suggested that they go on AZT. They have to be between 20 and 30 weeks gestation, and they have to intend to carry the pregnancy to term.